This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents Go Tell the Bees That I Am Gone by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter. Prologue. You know that something is coming. Something, a specific, dire, and awful something, will happen. You envision it, you push it away. It rolls slowly, inexorably back into your mind. You make what preparation you can, or you think you do, though your bones know the truth. There isn't any way to sidestep, accommodate, lessen the impact. It will come, and you will be helpless before it. You know these things. And yet somehow, you never think it will be today. Part 1. A Swarm of Bees in the Carcass of a Lion. Chapter 1. The Mackenzies are here. Fraser's Ridge, Colony of North Carolina, June the 17th, 1779. There was a stone under my right buttock, but I didn't want to move. The tiny heartbeat under my fingers was soft and stubborn. The fleeting jolts of life. The space between them was infinity, my connection to the dark sky and the rising flame.
"Move your arse a bit, Sassenach," said a voice in my ear. "I need to scratch my nose, and you're sitting on my hand."
Jamie twitched his fingers under me, and I moved, turning toward him as I shifted and resettled, keeping my hold on 3-year-old Mandy, bonelessly asleep in my arms. He smiled at me over Jem's tousled head and scratched his nose. It must have been past midnight, but the fire was still high, and the light sparked off the stubble of his beard and glowed as softly in his eyes as in his grandson's red hair and the shadowed folds of the worn plaid he'd wrapped about them both. On the other side of the fire, Brianna laughed, in the quiet way people laugh in the middle of the night with sleeping children near. She laid her head on Roger's shoulder, her eyes half closed. She looked completely exhausted, her hair unwashed and tangled, the firelight scooping deep hollows in her face. But happy.
"What is it you find funny, Ian?" Jamie asked, shifting Jem into a more comfortable position.
Jem was fighting as hard as he could to stay awake, but was losing the fight. He gaped enormously and shook his head, blinking like a dazed owl.
"What's funny?" he repeated.
But the last word trailed off, leaving him with his mouth half open and a glassy stare. His mother giggled, a lovely girlish sound, and I felt Jamie's smile.
"I just asked Daddy if he remembered a gathering we went 2 years ago. The clans were all called at a big bonfire, and I handed Daddy a burning branch and told him to go down to the fire and say the Mackenzies were there."
"Oh." Jem blinked once, then twice, looked at the fire blazing in front of us, and a slight frown formed between his soft red brows.
"Where are we now?"
"Home,"
Roger said firmly, and his eyes met mine, then passed to Jamie.
"For good."
Jamie let out the same breath I'd been holding since the afternoon when those four figures had appeared suddenly in the clearing below, and we had flown down the hill to meet them. There had been one moment of joyous, wordless explosion as we all flung ourselves at one another, and then the explosion had widened as Amy Higgins came out of her cabin, summoned by the noise, to be followed by Bobby, then Aidan, who had whooped at sight of Jem and tackled him, knocking him flat, with Ori and little Rob. Joe Beardsley had been in the woods nearby, heard the racket, and come to see, and within what seemed like moments the clearing was alive with people. 6 households were within reach of the news before sundown. The rest would undoubtedly hear of it tomorrow. The instant outpouring of Highland hospitality had been wonderful. Women and girls had run back to their cabins and fetched whatever they had baking or boiling for supper. The men had gathered wood, and at Jamie's behest, piled it on the crest where the outline of the new house stood, and we had welcomed home our family in style, surrounded by friends. Hundreds of questions had been asked of the travellers. Where had they come from? How was the journey? What had they seen? No one had asked if they were happy to be back. That was taken for granted by everyone. Neither Jamie nor I had asked any questions. Time enough for that. And now that we were alone, Roger had just answered the only one that truly mattered. The why of that answer, though. I felt the stirring of the hair on my nape. "Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof," I murmured into Mandy's black curls, and kissed her tiny, sleep-deaf ear. Once more my fingers probed inside her clothes, filthy from travel, but very well made, and found the hairline scar between her ribs, the whisper of the surgeon's knife that had saved her life 2 years ago, in a place so far from me. It thumped peacefully along, that brave little heart under my fingertips, and I blinked back tears. Not for the first time today, and surely not for the last.
"I was right, aye," Jamie said,
and I realized he'd said it for the second time.
"Right about what?"
"About needing more room," he said patiently,
and turned to gesture at the invisible rectangle of the stone foundation, the only tangible trace so far of the new house. The footprint of the original big house was still visible as a dark mark beneath the grass of the clearing below, but it had nearly faded away. Perhaps by the time the new house was finished, it would be only a memory.
Brianna yawned like a lion, then pushed back her tangled mane and blinked sleepily into the dark.
"We'll probably be sleeping in the root cellar this winter," she said, then laughed.
"Oh, ye of little faith," Jamie said, not at all perturbed. "The timber's sawn, split and milled. We'll have walls and floors and windows aplenty before snowfall. Maybe no glass in them yet," he added fairly, "but that can wait till the spring."
Brianna blinked again and shook her head, then stood up to look.
"Have you got a hearthstone?"
"I have. A lovely wee piece of serpentine. The greenstone, Ken."
"I remember. And you have a piece of iron to put under it."
Jamie looked surprised.
"Not yet, no. I'll find that when we bless the hearth, though."
"Well, then."
She sat up straight and fumbled among the folds of her cloak, emerging with a large canvas bag, clearly heavy and full of assorted objects. She delved about in this for a few moments, then pulled out something that gleamed black in the firelight.
"Use that, da," she said, handing it across to Jamie.
He looked at it for a moment, smiled, and handed it to me.
"Aye, that'll do," he said. "You brought it for the hearth?"
It was a smooth black metal chisel, 6 inches long and heavy in my hand, with the word "Craftsman" imprinted in the head.
"Well, for a hearth," Bree said, smiling at him.
She put her hand on Roger's leg.
"At first, I thought we might build a house ourselves when we could, but..."
She turned and looked across the darkness of the ridge into the vault of the cold, pure sky, where the Great Bear shone overhead.
"We might not manage before winter. And since I imagine we'll be imposing ourselves on you..."
She looked up from under her lashes at her father, who snorted.
"Dinna be daft, lass. If it's our house, it's yours. And you ken that well enough."
He raised a brow at her.
"And the more hands there are to help with the building of it, the better. Do you want to see the shape of it?"
Not waiting for an answer, he disentangled Jem from his plaid, eased him down on the ground beside me, and stood up. He pulled one of the burning branches from the fire and jerked his head in invitation toward the invisible rectangle of the new foundation. Bree was still drowsy, but game. She smiled at me and shook her head good-naturedly, then hunched her cloak over her shoulders and got up.
"Coming,"
she said to Roger. He smiled up at her and waved a hand, shooing her along.
I'm too knackered to see straight, love. I'll wait till the morning.
Bree touched his shoulder lightly and set off after the light of Jamie's torch, muttering something under her breath as she stumbled over a rock in the grass. And I laid a fold of my cloak over Jem, who hadn't stirred. Roger and I sat quiet, listening to their voices move away into the dark, and then sat quiet for a few moments longer, listening to the fire and the night, and each other's thoughts. For them to have risked the dangers of the travel, let alone the dangers of this time and this place. Whatever had happened in their own time? He gazed into my eyes, saw what I was thinking, and sighed.
Aye, it was bad. Bad enough, he said quietly. Even so, we might have gone back to deal with it. I wanted to. But we were afraid there wasn't anyone there Mandy could feel strongly enough.
Mandy? I looked down at the solid little body limp in sleep. Feel whom? And what do you mean, gone back? Wait. I lifted a hand in apology. No, don't try to tell me now. You're worn out, and there's time enough. I paused to clear my throat. And it's enough that you're here. He smiled then. A real smile. Though with the weariness of miles and years and terrible things behind it.
Aye, he said, it is.
We were silent for a time, and Roger's head nodded. I thought he was nearly asleep, and was gathering my legs under me to rise and collect everyone for bed, when he lifted his head again.
One thing.
Yes?
Have you met a man, ever, named William Buckley Mackenzie? Or maybe Buck Mackenzie?
I recall the name, I said slowly, but... Roger rubbed a hand over his face and slowly down his throat to the white scar left by the rope.
Well, he's the man who got me hanged to begin with, but he's also my 4 times great-grandfather. Neither one of us knew that at the time he got me hanged, he said, almost apologetically. Jesus H. Oh, I beg your pardon.
Are you still a sort of minister? He smiled at that, though the marks of exhaustion carved runnels in his face.
I don't think it wears off, he said, but if you were about to say Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I wouldn't mind it. Appropriate to the situation, you might say.
And in a few words, he told me how Buck Mackenzie had ended in Scotland in 1980, only to travel back with Roger in an effort to find Jem.
There's a great deal more to it than that, he assured me, but the end of it, for now, is that we left him in Scotland in 1739 with, his mother.
With Gaylis? My voice rose involuntarily, and Mandy twitched and made small, cranky noises. I patted her hastily and shifted her to a more comfortable position. Did you meet her?
Yes, interesting woman.
There was a mug on the ground beside him, still half full of beer. I could smell the yeast and bitter hops. He picked it up and seemed to be debating whether to drink it down or pour it over his head, but in the event took a gulp and set it down.
We wanted him to come with us. Of course there was the risk, but we'd managed to find enough gemstones. I thought we could make it all together, and his wife is here.
He waved vaguely toward the distant forest.
In America, I mean. Now.
I dimly recall that from your genealogy, though experience had taught me the limits of belief in anything recorded on paper. Roger nodded, drank more beer, and cleared his throat hard. His voice was hoarse and cracking from tiredness. I take it you forgave him for... I gestured briefly at my own throat. I could see the line of the rope and the shadow of the small scar I'd left on his when I did the emergency tracheotomy with a penknife and the amber mouthpiece of a pipe.
I loved him,
he said simply. A faint smile showed through the black stubble and the veil of tiredness.
How often do you get the chance to love someone who gave you your blood, their life, and them never knowing who you might be, or even if you'd exist at all?
Well, you do take chances when you have children, I said, and laid a hand gently on Jem's head.
It was warm, the hair unwashed but soft under my fingers. He and Mandy smelled like puppies, a sweet, thick animal scent, rich with innocence.
Yes,
Roger said softly.
You do.
Rustling grass and voices behind us heralded the return of the engineers. They were deep in a discussion of indoor plumbing.
Aye, maybe,
Jamie was saying, dubious.
But dinna ken if we can get all the things you'll need for it before the cold weather comes. I've just started digging a new privy, though. That'll see us through for the time being. Then in the spring...
Brianna said something in reply that I didn't catch, and then they were there, caught in the fire's halo, so alike to look at with the light glimmering on their long-nosed faces and ruddy hair. Roger stirred, getting his feet under him, and I stood up carefully, Mandy,
limp as her rag doll, Esmeralda.
It's wonderful, Mama,
Bree said, and hugged me to her, her body strong and straight and softly powerful, encompassing me, Mandy between us. She held me tight for a moment, then bent her head and kissed my forehead.
I love you,
she said, her voice soft and husky. I love you too, darling, I said, around the lump in my throat, and touched her face, so tired and radiant. She stepped back then and took Mandy from me, swinging her up against a shoulder with practiced ease.
Come on, pal,
she said to Jem, gently nudging him with the toe of her boot.
It's time for bed.
He made a sleepy, interrogative noise and half lifted his head, then collapsed again, soundly asleep.
Dinner fash, I'll get him.
Roger waved Jamie away and, stooping, rolled Jem into his arms and stood up with a grunt.
Do you mean to go down too? He asked. I can come back and take care of the fire as soon as I've put Jem down.
Jamie shook his head and put an arm around me.
Nay, dinna trouble yourself. We'll maybe sit a while and see the fire out.
They moved off slowly down the hill, shambling like cattle, to the accompaniment of clanking noises from Brianna's bag. The Higgins cabin, where they'd spend the night, showed as a tiny glimmer in the dark. Amy must have lit a lamp and pulled back the hide that covered the window. Jamie was still holding the chisel in his hand, eyes fixed on his daughter's disappearing back. He raised it and kissed it, as he'd once kissed the haft of his dirk before me. And I knew this, too, was a sacred promise. He put the chisel away in his sporran and took me in his arms, my back to him, so we could both watch them out of sight. He rested his chin on top of my head.
What are you thinking, Sassenach?
He said softly.
I saw your eyes. There are clouds in them.
I settled against him, feeling his warmth a bulwark at my back. The children, I said, hesitant. They... I mean, it's wonderful that they're here. To think we never see them again, and suddenly... I swallowed. Overcome by the dizzying joy of finding myself, finding us, once again, and so unexpectedly part of that remarkable thing, a family. To be able to see Jem and Mandy grow up. To have Bree and Roger again.
Aye,
he said, a smile in his voice.
But...
It took a moment, both to gather my thoughts and to put them into words. Roger said that something bad had happened in their own time. And you know it must have been something truly terrible.
Aye, he said, his voice hardening a little. Brianna said the same. But Ken and Ian, they've lived in this time before. They do know. I mean, what it's like. What it will be like.
The ongoing war, he meant, and I squeezed his hands clasped about my middle.
I don't think they do, I said softly, looking down across the broad cove.
They had vanished into the darkness.
Nobody knows who hasn't been there.
To war?
Aye, he said,
and held me, silent, his hand resting on my side over the scar of the wound made by a musket ball at Monmouth.
Aye, he said again after a long moment. I ken what you're saying, Sassenach. I thought my heart would burst when I saw Brianna, and kent it was really her and the bairns. But for all the joy of it.
See,
I missed them cruelly,
but I could take comfort in thinking they were safe.
Now.
He stopped, and I felt his heart beating against me, slow and steady. He took a deep breath, and the fire popped suddenly, a pocket of pitch exploding in sparks that disappeared into the night. A small reminder of the war that was rising slowly all around us.
I look at them, he said, and my heart is suddenly filled with...
Terror, I whispered, holding tight to him. Sheer terror.
Aye, he said. That.
We stood for a bit, watching the darkness below, letting joy return. The window of the Higgins cabin still glowed softly on the far side of the clearing below.
9 people in that cabin, I said.
I took a deep breath of the cool, spruce-scented night, envisioning the fug and humid warmth of 9 sleeping bodies occupying every horizontal inch of the place, with a cauldron and kettle steaming on the hearth. The second window bloomed into brightness.
4 of them ours, Jamie said,
and laughed softly.
I hope the place doesn't burn down.
Someone had put fresh wood on the fire, and sparks were beginning to dance above the chimney.
It will not burn down.
He turned me round to face him.
I want you, Anian, he said softly. Will you lie with me? It may be the last time we have any privacy for some while.
I opened my mouth to say, of course, and instead yawned hugely. I clapped a hand to my mouth, removing it to say, oh dear, I really didn't mean that. He was laughing, almost soundlessly. Shaking his head, he straightened out the rumpled quilt I'd been sitting on, knelt on it, and stretched up a hand to me.
Come, lie with me, and watch the stars for a bit, Sassenach. If you're still awake in 5 minutes, I'll take your clothes off and have you naked in the moonlight.
And if I'm asleep in 5 minutes? I kicked off my shoes and took his hand.
Then I won't bother taking your clothes off.
The fire was burning lower, but still steadily. I could feel the warm breeze of it touch my face and lift the hair at my temples. The stars were thick and bright, as diamonds spilled in some celestial burglary.
I shared this observation with Jamie, who made a very derogatory Scottish noise in response, but then lay back beside me, sighing in pleasure at the view.
Aye, they're bonny. Ken Cassiopeia there.
I looked at the approximate portion of the sky indicated by his nod, but shook my head. I'm complete rubbish at constellations.
I can see the Big Dipper, and I usually recognize Orion's Belt, but damned if I see it at the moment.
And the Pleiades are up there somewhere, aren't they?
They're part of Taurus, just there by the Hunter.
He stretched out an arm, pointing.
And that's Camelopardalis.
Oh, don't be silly. There isn't a giraffe constellation. I would have heard of that.
Well, it's no really in the sky just now, but there is one. And come to think, is it any more ridiculous than what's happened today?
No. I said softly, no, it's not. He put an arm around me and I rolled over to lay my cheek on his chest, and we watched the stars in silence listening to the wind in the trees and the slow beat of our hearts. It seemed a long time later when Jamie stirred and sighed.
I dinna think I've ever seen such stars, not since the night we made faith.
I lifted my head in surprise.
We seldom mention faith,
stillborn, but embedded in our hearts to each other, though each of us knew the other's feelings.
You know when she was conceived? I don't know that.
He ran his hand slowly down my back, fingers pausing to rub circles in the small of it. If I'd been a cat, I would have waved my tail gently under his nose.
Aye, well, I suppose I could be wrong, but I've always thought it was the night I went to your bed at the Abbey. There was a tall window at the end of the hall, and I saw the stars as I came to you. I thought it might be a sign to me to see my way clear.
For a moment, I groped among my memories. That time at the Abbey of St. Anne, when he'd come so close to a self-chosen death, was one I seldom revisited. It had been a terrifying time. Days full of fear and confusion running from one into the next, nights black with despair and desperation. And yet, when I did look back, I found a handful of vivid images standing out like the illuminated letters on a page of ancient Latin. Father Anselm's face pale in candlelight, his eyes warm with compassion, and then the growing glow of wonder as he heard my confession. The abbot's hands touching Jamie's forehead, eyes, lips, and palms, delicate as a hummingbird's touch, anointing his dying nephew with the holy chrism of extreme unction. The quiet of the darkened chapel where I prayed for his life and heard my prayer answered. And among these moments was the night when I woke from sleep to find him standing, a pale wraith by my bed, naked and freezing, so weak he could barely walk, but filled once more with life and a stubborn determination that would never leave him.
You remember faith, then? My hand rested lightly on my stomach, recalling.
He'd never seen her, or felt her as more than random kicks and pushes from inside me. He kissed my forehead briefly, then looked at me.
You can, I do. Don't you?
Yes. I just wanted you to tell me more.
Oh, I mean to.
He settled himself on one elbow and gathered me in so I could share his plaid.
Do you remember that too?
I asked, pulling down the fold of cloth he'd draped over me.
Sharing your plaid with me the night we met.
To keep you from freezing, aye.
He kissed the back of my neck.
It was me freezing at the Abbey. I'd worn myself out trying to walk and you wouldn't let me eat anything, so I was starving to death and...
Oh, you know that's not true. You...
Would I lie to you, Sassenach?
Yes, you bloody would, I said. You do it all the time.
But never mind that now. You were freezing and starving, and suddenly decided that instead of asking Brother Paul for a blanket or a bowl of something hot, you should stagger naked down a dark stone corridor and get in bed with me.
Some things are more important than food, Sassenach.
His hand settled firmly on my arse.
And finding out whether I could ever bed you again was more important than anything else just then. I reckoned if I couldn't, I'd just walk on out into the snow and not come back.
Naturally, it didn't occur to you to wait for a few more weeks and recover your strength.
Well, I was fairly sure I could walk that far, leaning on the walls. And I'd be doing the rest lying down, so why wait?
The hand on my arse was idly stroking it now.
You do recall the occasion.
It was like making love to a block of ice.
It had been.
It had also wrung my heart with tenderness, and filled me with a hope I'd thought I'd never know again.
Though you did thaw out after a bit.
Only a bit. At first, I just cradled him against me, trying as hard as possible to generate body heat. I'd pulled off my shift, urgent to get as much skin contact as possible. I remembered the hard, sharp curve of his hip bone, the knobs of his spine, and the ridged, fresh scars over them.
You weren't much more than skin and bones.
I turned, drew him down beside me now, and pulled him close, wanting the reassurance of his present warmth against the chill of memory. He was warm. And alive.
Very much alive.
You put your leg over me to keep me from falling out the bed. I remember that.
He rubbed my leg slowly, and I could hear the smile in his voice, though his face was dark with the fire behind him, sparking in his hair.
It was a small bed.
It had been. A narrow monastic cot, scarcely large enough for one normal-sized person. And even starved as he was, he'd occupied a lot of space.
I wanted to roll you onto your back, Sassenach, but I was afraid I'd pitch us both out onto the floor and... Well, I wasn't sure I could hold myself up.
He'd been shaking with cold and weakness, but now I realized, probably with fear as well. I took the hand resting on my hip and raised it to my mouth, kissing his knuckles. His fingers were cold from the evening air and tightened on the warmth of mine.
You managed, I said softly,
and rolled onto my back, bringing him with me.
Only just, he murmured, finding his way through the layers of quilt, plaid, shirt, and shift.
He let out a long breath, and so did I.
Oh, Jesus, Sassenach.
He moved, just a little.
What it felt like, he whispered. Then, to think I'd never have you again, and then...
He had managed, and it was just barely.
I thought I'd do it if it was the last thing I ever did.
It almost bloody was, I whispered back,
and took hold of his bottom, firm and round.
I really did think you died for a moment, until you started to move.
Thought I was going to,
he said, with the breath of a laugh.
Oh, God, Claire.
He stopped for a moment, lowered himself, and pressed his forehead against mine. He'd done it that night, too, cold-skinned and fierce with desperation, and I'd felt I was breathing my own life into him then, his mouth so soft and open, smelling faintly of the ale mixed with egg that was all he could keep down.
I wanted, he whispered. I wanted you, had to have you. But once I was inside you, I wanted...
He sighed then, deep, and moved deeper.
I thought I'd die of it then and there. And I wanted to. Wanted to go while I was inside you.
His voice had changed, still soft, but somehow distant, detached. And I knew he'd moved away from the present moment, gone back to the cold stone dark and the panic, the fear and overwhelming need.
I wanted to spill myself into you and let that be the last I ever knew. But then I started and I kent it wasn't meant to be that way, that I'd live, but that I would keep myself inside you forever, that I was giving you a child.
He'd come back, in the speaking, back into the now, and into me. I held him tight, big and solid and strong in my arms, but shaking, helpless as he gave himself up. I felt my own warm tears well up and slide down cold into my hair. After a time he stirred and rolled off onto his side. A big hand still rested light on my belly.
I did manage, I,
he said, and smiled a little, firelight soft on his face.
You did, I said.
And pulling the plaid back over us, I lay with him, content, in the light of dying flame and eternal stars. Chapter 2 A Blue Wine Day. Sheer exhaustion made Roger sleep like the dead, in spite of the fact that the Mackenzies' bed consisted of two ragged quilts that Amy Higgins had hastily dragged out of her piecework bag. These, laid over a week's worth of the Higgins' dirty laundry, and the Mackenzies' outer clothing used as blankets. It was a warm bed, though, with the heat of the smoured fire on one side and the body heat of two children and a snuggly wife on the other, and he'd fallen into sleep like a man falling down on well, with time for no more than the briefest prayer, though a profound one of gratitude. "We made it. Thanks." He woke to darkness and the smell of burnt wood and a freshly used chamber pot, feeling a sudden chill behind him. He had lain down with his back to the fire, but had rolled over during the night, and now saw the sullen glow of the last embers a couple of feet from his face, crimson veins in a bank of grey ash and charred wood. He put a hand behind him. Brianna was gone. There was a vague heap that must be Jem and Mandy at the far side of the quilt. The rest of the cabin was still somnolent, the air thick with heavy breathing. "Bree," he whispered, raising himself on one elbow. She was close, a solid shadow with her bottom braced against the wall by the hearth, standing on one foot to pull a stocking on. She put down her foot and crouched beside him, fingers brushing his face. "I'm going hunting with Da," she whispered, bending close. "Mama will watch the kids if you have things to do today."
"Aye. Where'd you get?"
He ran a hand down the side of her hip. She was wearing a thick hunting shirt and loose breeches, much patched. He could feel the roughness of the stitching under his palm.
"They're Da's," she said,
and kissed him, the tinge of firelight glistening in her hair. "Go back to sleep. It won't be dawn for another hour." He watched her step lightly through the bodies on the floor, boots in her hand, and a cold draught snaked through the room as the door opened and closed soundlessly behind her. Bobby Higgins said something in a sleep-slurred voice, and one of the little boys sat up, said, "What?" in a clear, startled voice, then flopped back into his quilt, dormant once more. The fresh air vanished into the comfortable fug, and the cabin slept again. Roger didn't. He lay on his back, feeling peace, relief, excitement, and trepidation in roughly equal proportions. They really had made it. All of them. He kept counting his family compulsively. All four of them, here and safe. Fragmented memories and sensations jostled through his mind. He let them flow through him, not trying to stay them or catch more than an image here and there. The weight of a small gold bar in his sweaty hand, the lurch of his stomach when he dropped it and seen it slide away across the tilting deck. The warm steam of parritch with whiskey on it, fortification against a freezing Scottish morning. Brianna hopping carefully down a flight of stairs on one foot, the bandaged one lifted, and the words of "My dame hath a lame tame crane" coming irresistibly to his mind. The smell of Buck's hair, acrid and unwashed, as they embraced each other on the edge of a dock, and a final farewell. Cold, endless, indistinguishable days and nights in the lurching hold of the Constance on their way to Charlestown. The four of them huddled in a corner behind the cargo, deafened by the smash of water against the hull, too seasick to be hungry, too tired even to be terrified, hypnotized instead by the rising water in the hold, watching it inch higher, splashing them with each sickening roll, trying to share their pitiful store of body heat to keep the kids alive. He let out the breath he hadn't realized he was holding, put his hands on the solid wooden floor to either side, closed his eyes, and let it all drain away. No looking back. They'd made their decision, and they'd made it here. To sanctuary. So now what? He'd lived in this cabin once, for a long time.
Now he supposed he'd build a new one. Jamie had told him last night that the land Governor Trian had given him was still his, registered in his name. A small thrill of anticipation rose in his heart. The day lay before him, the beginning of a new life. What should he do first?
Daddy!
A voice with a lot of spit whispered loudly in his ear.
Daddy, I have go body.
He sat up, smiling, pushing cloaks and shirts out of the way. Mandy was hopping from foot to foot in agitation, a small black bird solid against the shadows. Aye, sweetheart, he whispered back, and took her hand, warm and sticky. I'll take you to the privy. Try not to step on anybody. Mandy had encountered quite a few privies by now, and wasn't put off by this one. When Roger opened the door, though, a huge spider dropped suddenly down from the lintel and hung swaying like a plumb bob, inches from his face. He and Mandy both screamed. Well, she did. His own effort was no more than a croak, but a manly croak, at least. There was no real light yet. The spider was a black blob with an impression of legs, but all the more alarming for that. Alarmed in turn by their cries, the spider hurried back up its thread into whatever invisible recess it normally occupied.
"Not going in there,"
Mandy said, backing up against his legs. Roger shared her feelings, but taking her off the trail into the bushes in the dark held the threat not only of further and possibly larger spiders, or snakes and bats, but also of the things that hunted in the crepuscule. Panthers, for instance. Aidan McCullum had entertained them earlier with a story about meeting a painter on his way to the privy. This privy.
"That's all right, honey."
He bent and picked her up.
"It's gone. It's afraid of us. It won't come back."
"I scared."
"I know, sweetie. Don't worry. I don't think it will come back, but I'll kill it if it does."
"With a gun?"
she asked hopefully.
"Yes,"
he said firmly, and clutching her to his chest, he ducked under the lintel, remembering, too late, Claire's own story about the enormous rattlesnake perched on the seat of their privy. In the event, though, nothing untoward occurred, save his nearly losing Mandy down the hole when she let go her grip to try to wipe her bottom with a dried corn cob. Sweating slightly in spite of the chilly morning air, he made his way back to the cabin to find that in his absence the Higginses and Jem and Germain had risen en masse. Amy Higgins blinked slightly when told that Brianna had gone a-hunting, but when Roger added that she had gone with her father, the look of surprise faded into a nod of acceptance that made Roger smile inwardly. He was glad to see that himself's personality still dominated the ridge, despite his long absence. Claire had told him last night that he'd only come back from exile the month before.
"Are there many new folk come to settle since we were last here?"
he asked Bobby, sitting down on the bench beside his host, bowl of porridge in his hand.
"A mort of them," Bobby assured him. 20 families at least. A bit of milk and honey, preacher."
He pushed the honey pot companionably in Roger's direction. Being an Englishman, Bobby was allowed such frivolities with his breakfast, rather than the severe Scottish pinch of salt.
"Oh, sorry, I should have asked. Are you still a preacher?"
Claire had asked him that last night, but it still came as a surprise.
"I am, aye,"
he said, and reached for the milk jug. In fact, both question and answer made his heart speed up. He was a minister. He just wasn't sure how official he was. Granted, he'd christened, married, and buried the people of the ridge for a year or more, and preached to them, as well as doing the lesser offices of a minister, and they'd all thought of him as such. No doubt they still did. On the other hand, he was not formally ordained as a Presbyterian minister. Not quite.
"I'll maybe call on the new folk," he said casually. "Do you ken whether they're any of them Catholic or otherwise?"
This was a rhetorical question. Everyone on the ridge knew the nature of everyone else's beliefs and weren't at all shy of discussing them.
if not always to their faces. Amy plunked a tin mug of chicory coffee by his ball and sat down to her own salted porridge with a sigh of relief. 15 Catholic families, she said, 12 Presbyterians, and 3 Blue Light. Methodies, aye? You'll want to watch out for thon folk, preacher. Oh, and maybe 2 Anglicans. Ori! She sprang up, just in time to interrupt 6-year-old Ori, who'd been stealthily, if unsteadily, lifting the full chamber pot above his head with the clear intent of emptying it over Jem, who was sitting cross-legged by the fire, blinking sleepily at the shoe in his hand. Startled by his mother's cry, Ori dropped the chamber pot, more or less missing Jem, but decanting its fetid contents into the newly stirred fire, and ran for the door. His mother pursued him, pausing only to snatch up a broom. Enraged Gallic shouts and high-pitched yelps of terror receded into the distance. Jem, to whom mourning was anathema, looked at the spluttering mess in the hearth, wrinkled his nose, and stood up. He swayed for a moment, then ambled to the table and sat down next to Roger, yawning. There was silence. A charred log broke suddenly in the hearth, and a spurt of sparks flew out of the mess, like a final comment on the state of things. Roger cleared his throat.
Man that is born of woman is full of trouble as the sparks that fly upward, he observed.
Bobby slowly turned his head from contemplation of the hearth to look at Roger. His eyes were smoke-reddened, and the old M brand on his cheek showed white in the dim light of the cabin.
Well put, preacher, he said. Welcome back.
It was what her mother called a blue wine day, one where air and sky were one thing together and every breath intoxication. Chestnut and oak leaves crackled with each step, the scent of them sharp as that of the pine needles higher up. They were climbing the mountain, guns in hand, and Brianna Fraser Mackenzie was one with the day. Her father held back a hemlock branch for her, and she ducked past to join him.
Fear Mielish,
he said, gesturing to the wide meadow that opened out before them.
Recall any of the Gaelic, do you, lass?
You said something about the grass, she said, scrabbling hastily through her mental closets. But I don't know the other word.
Sweet grass. That's what we call this wee meadow. Good pasture, but too great a climb for most of the stock. And you dinna want to leave them here for days untended because of painters and bears.
The whole of the meadow rippled, the silver-green heads of millions of grass stems in movement catching morning sun. Here and there yellow and white butterflies cruised, and at the far side of the grass there was a sudden crash as some large ungulate vanished into the brush, leaving branches swaying in its wake.
A certain amount of competition as well, I see, she said, nodding toward the place where the animal had disappeared. She lifted an eyebrow, wanting to ask whether they shouldn't pursue it, but assuming that her father had some good reason why not, since he made no move.
Aye, some, he said,
and turned to the right, moving along the edge of the trees that rimmed the meadow.
But deer dinna feed the same way cattle or sheep do, at least not if the pasture's good. That was an old buck, he added offhandedly over his shoulder. We dinna need to kill those in summer. There's better meat and plenty of it.
She raised both brows, but followed without comment. He turned his head and smiled at her.
Where there's one, there's likely more this time of year. The does and the new fawns begin to gather into wee herds. It's nowhere near rut yet, but the bucks are always thinking on it. He kens well enough where they are.
He nodded in the direction of the vanished deer. She suppressed a smile, recalling some of her mother's uncensored opinions on men and the functions of testosterone. He saw it, though, and gave her a half-rueful look of amusement, knowing what she was thinking, and the fact that he did sent a small, sweet pang through her heart.
"Aye, well, your mother's right about men," he said, with a shrug. "Keep it in mind, Aeneen. he added more seriously.
He turned then, lifting his face into the breeze.
They're near the meadow, but downwind of us. We won't get near, see if we climb up and come down on them from the far side of the ridge.
He nodded toward the west, though, across the meadow.
I thought we'd maybe stop by young Ian's place first, though, if you didn't mind.
Mind? No. She felt a surge of delight at the mention of her cousin.
Somebody by the fire last night says he's married now. Who did he marry?
She was more than curious about Ian's wife. Some 10 years before, he'd asked her to marry him. And while that had been a counsel of desperation, and completely ridiculous to boot, she was aware that the thought of bedding her hadn't been unwelcome to him. Later, with both of them adults, and her married, him divorced from his Indian wife, a sense of physical attraction had been silently acknowledged between them, and just as silently dismissed. Still, there were echoes of fondness between them, and she hoped she would like Ian's unknown wife. Her father laughed.
You'll like her, lass. Rachel Hunter is her name. She's a Quaker.
A vision of a drab little woman with downcast eyes came to her, but her father caught the look of doubt on her face and shook his head.
She's no what you think. She speaks her mind. And Ian's mad in love with her, and she with him.
Oh, that's good.
She meant it, but her father cast her an amused glance, one brow raised. He said nothing further, though, and turned to lead the way through the rippling waves of fragrant grass. Ian's cabin was charming. Not that it was markedly different from any other mountain cabin Brianna had ever seen, but it was sited in the midst of an aspen grove, and the fluttering leaves broke the sunlight into a flurry of light and shadow, so that the cabin had an air of magic about it, as though it might disappear into the trees altogether if you looked away. 4 goats and 2 kids poked their heads over the fence of their pen and started a congenial racket of greeting, but no one came out to see who the visitors were.
"They've gone somewhere," Jamie remarked, squinting at the house. "Is that a note on the door?"
It was. A scrap of paper pinned to the door with a long thorn, with a line of incomprehensible writing that Bree finally recognised as Gaelic.
"Is young Ian's wife a Scot?" she asked, frowning at the words. The only ones she could make out were, she thought, Macree and Goat.
"Nay, that's from Jenny,"
her father said, whipping out his spectacles and scanning the note.
"She says she and Rachel are away to a quilting at the Macrees, and if Ian comes home before they do, will he milk the goats and set half the milk aside for cheese?"
As though hearing their names called, a chorus of loud meh's came from the goat pen.
"Evidently Ian's not home yet either," Brianna observed. "Do they need to be milked now, do you think? I probably remember how."
Her father smiled at the thought, but shook his head.
"Nay, Jenny will have stripped them no more than a few hours ago. They'll do fine until the evening."
Until that moment, she'd been idly supposing Jenny to be the name of a hired girl. But hearing the tone in which Jamie had said it, she blinked.
"Jenny? Your sister Jenny?" she said, incredulous. "She's here?"
He looked mildly startled.
"Aye, she is. I'm sorry, lass. I never stopped to think you didn't ken that. She..." "Wait."
He lifted a hand, looking at her intently.
"The letters. We wrote, well, Claire mostly wrote them, but..."
"We got them." She felt breathless, the same feeling she'd had when Roger had brought back the wooden box with Jemmy's full name burned into the lid, and they'd opened it to find the letters. And the overwhelming sense of relief, joy, and sorrow when she opened the first letter to see the words, "We are alive." The same feeling swept through her now,
and tears took her unaware so that everything around her flickered and blurred as though the cabin and her father and she herself might be about to disappear altogether, dissolved into the shimmering light of the aspen trees. She made a small, choking sound, and her father's arm came around her, holding her close.
"We never thought we should see you again,"
he whispered into her hair, his own voice choked.
"Never, Elena.
I was afraid. So afraid you hadn't reached safety that you'd died, all of you, lost in there.
And we'd never know."
"We couldn't tell you." She lifted her head from his shoulder and wiped her nose on the back of her hand. "But you could tell us. Those letters. Knowing you were alive, I mean." She stopped suddenly, and blinking away the last of the tears, saw Jamie look away, blinking back his own.
"But we weren't," he said softly. "We were dead when you read those letters."
"No, you weren't," she said fiercely, gripping his hand. "I wouldn't read the letters all at once. I spaced them out. Because as long as there were still unopened letters, you were still alive."
"None of it matters, lass," he said at last, very softly.
He raised her hand and kissed her knuckles, his breath warm and light on her skin.
"You're here. So are we. Nothing else matters at all."
Brianna was carrying the family fowling piece, while her father had his good rifle. She wouldn't fire on any birds or small game, though, while there was a chance of spooking deer nearby. It was a steep climb, and she found herself puffing, sweat starting to pearl behind her ears in spite of the cool day. Her father climbed, as ever, like a mountain goat, without the slightest appearance of strain, but, to her chagrin, noticed her struggling and beckoned her aside onto a small ledge.
"We're in nae hurry, Aeneen," he said, smiling at her. "There's water here."
He reached out with an obvious tentativeness and touched her flushed cheek, quickly taking back his hand.
"Sorry, lass," he said, and smiled. "I'm no used yet to the notion that you're real."
"I know what you mean," she said softly. Swallowing, she reached out and touched his face, warm and clean-shaven, slanted eyes deep blue as hers.
"Oh,"
he said, under his breath, and gently brought her into his arms again. They stood that way, not speaking, listening to the cry of ravens circling overhead and the trickling of water on rock.
"Come and drink, Aeneen," he said, letting go as gently as he'd grasped her,
and turning her toward a tiny freshet that ran down a crevice between two rocks. The water was icy and tasted of granite, and the faint turpentine tang of pine needles. She'd slaked her thirst and was splashing water on her flushed cheeks when she felt her father make a sudden movement. She froze at once, cutting her eyes at him. He also stood frozen, but he lifted both eyes and chin a little, signalling to the slope above them. She saw and heard it then. A slow crumble of falling dirt that broke loose and hit the ledge beside her foot with a tiny rattle of pebbles. This was followed by silence, except for the calling of the ravens. That was louder, she thought, as though the birds were nearer. "They see something," she thought. They were nearer. A raven swooped suddenly, flashing unnervingly near her head, and another screamed from above. A sudden boom from the outcrop overhead nearly made her lose her footing, and she grabbed a handful of saplings sticking out of the rock face by reflex. Just in time, too, for there was a thump and a slithering noise above, and at what seemed the same instant, something huge fell past in a shower of dirt and gravel, bouncing off the ledge next to her in an explosion of breath, blood, and impact, before landing with a crash in the bushes below.
"Blessed Michael defend us,"
said her father in Gaelic, crossing himself. He peered down into the thrashing bush below. Jesus, whatever it was still alive. Then up.
"Weh," said an impassioned male voice from above.
She didn't recognize the word, but she did know the voice, and joy burst over her.
Ian, she called.
There was total silence from above, save for the ravens, who were getting steadily more upset.
Blessed Michael defend us, said a startled voice in Gaelic,
and an instant later her cousin Ian had dropped onto their narrow ledge where he balanced with no apparent difficulty.
It is you, she said. Oh, Ian!
A harridge.
He grabbed her and squeezed tight, laughing in disbelief.
God, it's you!
He drew back for an instant for a good look to confirm it, laughed again in delight, kissed her solidly, and re-squeezed. He smelled like buckskin, porridge, and gunpowder, and she could feel his heart thumping against her own chest. She vaguely heard a scrabbling noise, and as they let go of each other, she realized her father had dropped off the ledge and was half sliding down the scree below it, toward the brush where the deer, it must have been a deer, had fallen. He halted for a moment at the edge of the brushy growth. The bushes were still thrashing, but the movements of the wounded deer were growing less violent. Then drew his dirk, and with a muttered remark in Gaelic, waded gingerly into the brush.
It's all rose briars down there, Ian said, peering over her shoulder. But I think he'll make it in time to cut the throat. Ah, yeah, it was a bad shot and I was afraid I... But what the... how is it you're here?
He stood back a little, his eyes running over her, the corner of his mouth turning up slightly as he noted her breeches and leather hiking shoes. This fading as his eyes returned to her face, worried now.
Is your man not with you? And the bairns?
Yes, they are, she assured him. Roger's probably hammering things, and Jem's helping him, and Mandy's getting in the way.
As for what we're doing here...
The day and the joy of reunion had let her ignore the recent past, but the ultimate need of explanation brought the enormity of it all suddenly crashing in upon her.
Dinna fash, cousin. Ian said swiftly, seeing her face. It'll bide.
D'ye think you recall how to shoot a turkey?
There's a band o' 'em strutting to and fro like folk dancing strip the willow at a ceilidh, not a quarter mile from here.
Oh, I might.
She'd propped the gun against the cliff face while she drank. The deer's fall had knocked it over, and she picked it up, checking. The fall had knocked the flint askew, and she reseated it. The thrashing below had stopped, and she could hear her father's voice in snatches above the wind, saying the Gralach prayer.
Hadn't we better help Da with the deer, though?
Ach, it's no but a yearling buck. He'll have it done before you can blink.
Ian leaned out from the ledge, calling down,
I'm taking Bree to shoot turkeys, Abraha Mumaha.
Dead silence from below. And then a lot of rustling, and Jamie's dishevelled head poked suddenly up above the rose briars. His hair was loose and tangled, his face was deeply flushed and bleeding in several places, as were his arms and hands, and he looked displeased.
Ian, he said in measured tones, but in a voice loud enough to be easily heard above the forest sounds. MacIan, MacIan.
We'll be back to help carry the meat. Ian called back. He waved cheerily, and grabbing the fowling piece, caught Bree's eye and jerked his chin upward. She glanced down, but her father had disappeared, leaving the bushes swaying in agitation. She'd lost much of her eye for the wilderness, she found. The cliff looked impassable to her, but Ian scrambled up as easily as a baboon, and after a moment's hesitation she followed, much more slowly, slipping now and then in small showers of dirt, as she groped for the holes her cousin had used.
Ian MacIan MacIan? She asked, reaching the top and pausing to empty the dirt out of her shoes.
Her heart was beating unpleasantly hard.
Is that like me calling Jem Jeremiah Alexander Ian Fraser MacKenzie when I'm annoyed with him?
Something like, Ian said, shrugging. Ian, son of Ian, son of Ian. The notion is to point out you're a disgrace to your forefathers, eh?
He was wearing a ragged, filthy calico shirt, but but the sleeves had been torn off, and she saw a large white scar in the shape of a four-pointed star on the curve of his bare brown shoulder. "What did that?" she said, nodding at it. He glanced at it and made a dismissive gesture, turning to lead her across the small ridge.
"Ach, not much," he said. "An Abenaki bastard shot me with an arrow at Monmouth.
Then he cut it out for me a few days after. That's Denzel Hunter," he added, seeing her blank look. "Rachel's brother. He's a doctor, like your mam."
"Rachel!" she exclaimed. "Your wife?"
A huge grin spread across his face.
"She is," he said simply. "Thank the year."
Then looked quickly at her to see if she'd understood.
"I remember, thanks be to God," she assured him, "and quite a bit more.
Roger spent most of the voyage from Scotland refreshing our Gaelic.
Da also told me Rachel's a Quaker."
She made it a question, stretching to step across the stones in a tiny brook.
"Aye, she is."
Ian's eyes were fixed on the stones, but she thought he spoke with a bit less joy and pride than he'd had a moment before. She left it alone, though. If there was a conflict, and she couldn't quite see how there wouldn't be, given what she knew about her cousin and what she thought she knew about Quakers, this wasn't the time to ask questions. Not that such consideration stopped Ian.
"From Scotland," he said, turning his head to look back at her over his shoulder. "When?"
Then his face changed suddenly as he realized the ambiguity of "when," and he made an apologetic gesture, dismissing the question.
"We left Edinburgh in March," she said, taking the simplest answer for now. "I'll tell you the rest later."
He nodded, and for a time they walked, sometimes together, sometimes with Ian leading, finding deer trails or cutting upward to go around a thick growth of bush. She was happy to follow him, so she could look at him without embarrassing him with her scrutiny. He'd changed. No great wonder there. Still tall and very lean, but hardened. A man grown fully into himself, the long muscles of his arms clear-cut under his skin. His brown hair was darker, plaited and tied with a leather thong, and adorned with what looked like very fresh turkey feathers bound into the braid.
"For good luck," she wondered.
He picked up the bow and quiver he'd left at the top of the cliff, and the quiver swung gently now against his back. But the expression of a well-made man appears not only in his face, she thought, entertained. It is in his limbs and joints also. It is curiously in the joints of his hips and wrists. It is in his walk, the carriage of his neck, the flex of his waist and knees. Dress does not hide him. The poem had always summoned Roger for her, but now it encompassed Ian and her father as well, different as the three of them were. As they rose higher and the timber opened out, the breeze rose and freshened, and Ian halted, beckoning her with a small movement of his fingers.
"Do you hear them?" he breathed in her ear.
She did, and the hairs rippled pleasantly down her backbone. Small, harsh yelps, almost like a barking dog. And, farther off, a sort of intermittent purr, something between a large cat and a small motor.
"Best take off your stockings and rub your legs with dirt," Ian whispered, motioning toward her woolen stockings. "Your hands and face as well."
She nodded, set the gun against a tree, and scratched dry leaves away from a patch of soil moist enough to rub on her skin. Ian, his own skin nearly the colour of his buckskins, needed no such camouflage. He moved silently away while she was anointing her hands and face, and when she looked up, she couldn't see him for a moment. Then there was a series of sounds like a rusty door hinge swinging to and fro, and suddenly she saw Ian standing stock still behind a sweet gum some 50 feet away. The forest seemed to go dead for an instant, the soft scratchings and leaf murmurs ceasing. Then there was an angry gobble, and she turned her head as slowly as she could to see a tom turkey poke his pale blue head out of the grass and looked sharp from side to side, wattles bright red and swinging, looking for the challenger. She cut her eyes at Ian, his hands cupped at his mouth, but he didn't move or make a sound. She held her breath and looked back at the turkey, who emitted another loud gobble. This one echoed by another tom at a distance. The turkey she was watching glanced back toward that sound, lifted his head and yelped, listened for a moment, and then ducked back into the grass. She glanced at Ian. He caught her movement and shook his head very slightly. They waited for the space of 16 slow breaths, she counted, and then Ian gobbled again. The tom popped out of the grass and strode across a patch of open, leaf-packed ground, blood in his eye, breast feathers puffed, and tail fanned and vibrating. He paused for a moment to allow the woods to admire his magnificence, then commenced strutting slowly to and fro, uttering harsh, aggressive cries. Moving only her eyeballs, she glanced back and forth between the strutting tom and Ian, who timed his movements to those of the turkey, sliding the bow from his shoulder, freezing, bringing an arrow to hand, freezing, and finally knocking the arrow as the bird made its final turn. Or what should have been its final turn? Ian bent his bow and in the same movement released his arrow and uttered a startled, all-too-human yelp as a large, dark object dropped from the tree above him. He jerked back, and the turkey barely missed landing on his head. She could see it now, a hen, feathers fluffed in fright, running with neck outstretched across the open ground toward the equally startled tom, who had deflated in shock. By reflex, she seized her shotgun, brought it to bear, and fired. She missed, and both turkeys disappeared into a patch of ferns, making noises that sounded like a small hammer striking a woodblock. The echoes died away, and the leaves of the trees settled back into their murmur. She looked at her cousin, who glanced at his bow, then across the open ground to where his arrow was sticking absurdly out from between two rocks. He looked at her, and they both burst into laughter.
"I will," he said philosophically. "That's what we get for leaving Uncle Jimmy to pick roses by himself."
Brianna swabbed the barrel and rammed a wad of tow on a fresh round of buckshot. Hard, to stop her hand shaking.
"Sorry I missed," she said.
"Why?"
Ian looked at her, surprised. "When you're hunting, you're lucky to get one shot in 10. You can that fine. Besides, I missed too."
"Only because a turkey fell on your head," she said, but laughed.
"Is your arrow ruined?"
"Aye," he said, showing her the broken shaft he'd retrieved from the rocks. "The head'll do, though."
He stripped the sharp iron head and put it in his sporran, tossed the shaft away, then stood up.
"We'll no get another shot at that lot. But
what's amiss, lass?" She'd tried to shove her ramrod into its pipe, but missed and sent it flying.
"What do they call it when you're too excited to hit a deer? Buck fever?" she said, making light of it as she went to fetch the rod. "Turkey fever, I suppose."
"Oh, aye," he said, and smiled.
But his eyes were intent on her hands.
"How long since you fired a gun, cousin?"
"Not that long," she said tersely.
She hadn't expected it to come back.
"Maybe 6-7 months?
"What were you hunting then?" he asked, head on one side.
She glanced at him, made the decision, and pushing the ramrod carefully home, turned to face him.
"A gang of men who were hiding in my house, waiting to kill me and take my kids," she said.
The words, bald as they were, sounded ridiculous, melodramatic. Both his feathery brows went up.
"Did you get them?"
His tone was so interested that she laughed in spite of the memories.
He might have been asking if she'd caught a large fish.
"No, alas. I shot out the tire on their truck and one of the windows in my own house. I didn't get them.
But then," she added with affected casualness,
They didn't get me or the kids either.
Her knees felt suddenly weak, and she sat down carefully on a fallen log. He nodded, accepting what she'd said with a matter-of-factness that would have astonished her, had it been any other man.
That would be why you're here, eh?
He glanced around, quite unconsciously, as though scanning the forest for possible enemies, and she wondered, suddenly, what it would be like to live with Ian, never knowing whether you were talking to the Scot or the Mohawk. And now she was really curious about Rachel.
Mostly, yes, she answered.
He picked up her tone and glanced sharply at her, but nodded again.
Will you go back, then, to kill them?
This was said seriously, and it was with an effort that she tamped down the rage that seared through her when she thought of Rob Cameron and his bloody accomplices. It wasn't fear or flashback that made her hands shake now. It was the memory of the overwhelming urge to kill that had possessed her when she touched the trigger.
I wish, she said shortly. We can't. Physically, I mean.
She flapped a hand, pushing it all away.
I'll tell it to you later. We haven't even talked to Da and Mama about it yet. We only came last night.
As though reminded of the long, hard push upward through the mountain passes, she yawned suddenly, hugely. Ian laughed, and she shook her head, blinking.
"Do I remember Da saying you have a baby?" she asked, firmly changing the subject.
The huge grin came back.
"I have," he said, his face shining with such joy that she smiled too. "I've got a wee son. He hasn't got his real name yet, but we call him Oggy, for Oglethorpe," he explained, seeing her smile widen at the name. "We were in Savannah when he started to show. I can't wait for you to see him."
"Neither can I," she said, though the connection between Savannah and the name Oglethorpe escaped her.
"Should we?"
A distant noise cut her short, and Ian was on his feet instantly looking.
"Was that Da?"
she asked.
"I think so."
Ian gave her a hand and hauled her to her feet, snatching up his bow almost in the same motion. "Come." She grabbed the newly loaded gun and ran, careless of brush, stones, tree branches, creeks, or anything else. Ian slithered through the wood like a fast-moving snake. She bowled her way through behind him, breaking branches and dashing a sleeve across her face to clear her eyes. Twice, Ian came to a sudden halt, grasping her arm as she huddled toward him. Together they stood listening, trying to still pounding hearts and gasping breaths long enough to hear anything above the sough of the forest. The first time, after what seemed like agonized minutes, they caught a sort of squalling noise above the wind, tailing off into grunts.
"Pig?"
she asked, between gulps of air. Wild hogs could be big and very dangerous. Ian shook his head, swallowing.
"Bear,"
he said, and drawing a huge breath, seized her hand and pulled her into a run. The second time they stopped for bearings, they heard nothing.
"Uncle Jimmy,"
Ian shouted as soon as he had enough breath to do so. Nothing. And Brianna screamed, "Da!" as loud as she could. A pitifully small, futile sound in the immensity of the mountain. They waited, shouted, waited again, and after the final shout and silence, ran on again, Ian leading the way back toward the rosebriars and the dead deer. They came to a stumbling halt on the high ground above the hollow, chests heaving for air. Brianna seized Ian's arm. "There's something down there." The bushes were shaking. Not as they had during the deer's death struggles, but definitely shaking, disturbed by the intermittent movements of something clearly bigger than Jamie Fraser. From here, she could clearly hear grunting and the slobber of rending tendons, breaking bones, and chewing.
"Oh, Christ,"
Ian said under his breath, but not far enough under, and terror sent a bolt of black dizziness through her chest. In spite of that, she gulped as much air as she could and screamed, "Da!" once more.
"Ugh, now you turn up,"
said a deep, irascible Scottish voice from somewhere below their feet.
"I hope you've a turkey for the pot, lass, for we'll no be having venison tonight."
She flung herself flat on the ground, head hung over the edge of the cliff, dizzy with relief at seeing her father 10 feet below, standing on the narrow ledge to which he'd led her earlier. His frown relaxed as he saw her above.
"All right then, lass," he asked.
"Yes," she said, "but no turkeys." "What on earth happened to you?" He was dishevelled and scratched, spots and rivulets of dried blood marking his arms and face, and a large rent in one sleeve. His right foot was bare, and his shin was heavily streaked with blood. He looked down from the ledge, and the glower returned.
"I just got Ian's deer skinned when yon fat, hairy devil came out of the bushes and took it from me."
Ian was squatting beside Brianna, surveying the rose briars. She took her attention off her father for a moment and caught a glimpse of something very large and black among the bushes, working at something in a concentrating manner. The bushes snapped and quivered as it ripped at the deer, and she caught sight of one stiff, quivering hoofed leg among the leaves. The sight of the bear, brief as it was, caused a rush of adrenaline so visceral that it made her whole body tighten and her head feel light. She breathed as deep as she could, feeling sweat trickle down her back, her hands wet on the metal of the gun. She came back to herself in time to hear Ian asking Jamie what had happened to his leg.
"I kicked it in the face," Jamie replied briefly, with a glance of dislike toward the bushes. "It took a fence and tried to take my foot off, but it only got my shoe."
Ian quivered slightly beside her, but wisely didn't laugh.
"Aye, do you want to hand up, uncle?"
"I do not," Jamie replied tersely.
"I'm waiting for the Mac na Gaelic to leave. I've got my rifle."
"Ah," Ian said, properly appreciating the importance of this. Her father's rifle was a very fine one, a long rifle from Pennsylvania, he told her. Plainly, he was prepared to wait as long as it took, and was probably a lot more stubborn than the bear, she thought, with a small interior gurgle.
"You may as well go on," Jamie said, looking up at them. "It may be a wee while."
"I could probably shoot it from here," Bree offered, judging the distance. "I can't kill it, but a load of birdshot might make it leave." Her father made a Scottish noise in response to this and a violent gesture of prevention.
"Dinna try it," he said. "All you'll do is maybe madden it. And if I could get down that slope, yon beast can certainly get up it. Now away with you. I'm getting a crick in my neck, talking up at you."
Bree gave Ian a sidelong glance, and he gave her back the ghost of a nod, acknowledging her reluctance to leave her father shoeless on a ledge no more than 20 feet from a hungry bear.
"We'll bear you company for a bit," he announced.
And before Jamie could object, Ian had grasped a stout pine sapling and swung himself down onto the cliff face, where his moccasined toes at once found a hold. Brianna, following his example, leaned over and dropped her fowling piece into her father's hand before finding her own way down more slowly.
"I'm surprised you didn't have at it with your dirk, Uncle Jamie," Ian was saying. "Bear killer, is it, that the Tuscarora called you?"
Bree was pleased to see that Jamie had regained his equanimity, and gave Ian no more than a pitying look.
"Are you maybe familiar with a saying about how a man grows wiser with age?" he inquired.
"Aye," Ian replied, looking baffled.
"Well, if you dinna grow wiser, you're no likely to grow older," Jamie said, leaning the gun against the cliff. "And I'm old enough to ken better than to fight a bear wi' a dirk for a deer's carcass. Have you anything to eat, lass?"
She had quite forgotten the small bag over her shoulder, but she now took it off and groped inside, removing a small packet of bannocks and cheese supplied by Amy Higgins. "Sit down," she said, handing this to her father. "I want to look at your leg."
"It's no bad," he said.
But he was either too hungry to argue or simply conditioned to accept unwanted medical treatment by her mother, for he did sit down and stretch out the wounded leg. It wasn't as bad as he'd said, though there was a deep puncture wound in his calf with a couple of long scrapes beside it. These presumably left as he'd hastily pulled his foot out of the bear's mouth, she thought, feeling a little faint at the vision of this. She had nothing with her of use save a large handkerchief, but she soaked this in the icy water from the rivulet that flowed down the cliff face and cleaned the wound as well as she could. Could you get tetanus from a bear's bite, she wondered, swabbing and rinsing. She'd made sure to have all the kids' shots up to date, including tetanus, before they'd left. But a tetanus immunization was only good for, what, 10 years? Something like that. The puncture wound was still oozing blood, but not gushing. She wrung out the cloth and tied it firmly, but not too tightly, around his calf.
Tapaliat agri, he said,
and smiled at her.
Your mother couldn't have done better.
Here. He'd saved 2 bannocks and a bit of cheese for her, and she leaned back against the cliff between him and Ian, surprised to discover that she was very hungry, and even more surprised to realize that she wasn't worried by the fact that they were chatting away in the near vicinity of a large carnivorous animal that could undoubtedly kill them all.
Bears are lazy, Ian told her,
observing the direction of her glance.
If he... Is it a he-bear, Uncle? Has a fine deer down there. He'll no bother to climb all the way up here for a scrawny wee snack.
Speaking of which... He leaned past her to address Jamie.
Did he eat your sandal? I didn't stay to watch, Jamie said,
his temper seeming to have calmed as a result of food.
But I've hopes that he didn't. After all, we have a perfectly good pile of steaming deer guts just at hand. Why would you bother with a piece of old leather? Bears aren't fools.
Ian nodded at this and leaned back against the cliff, rubbing his shoulders gently on the sun-warmed stone.
So then, cousin, he said to Bree, you said you'd tell me how it was you came home, as we've likely a bit of time to pass.
He nodded toward the now rhythmic noises of tearing flesh and mastication below. The bottom of her stomach dropped abruptly, and her father, seeing her face, patted her knee.
Dinna trouble yourself, Olenin. Time enough. Perhaps you'd rather tell it to everyone when Roger Mack's with you.
She hesitated for a moment. She'd visualized it many times, telling her parents the whole of it, imagining herself and Roger telling the tale together, taking turns. But seeing the intent look in her father's eyes, she realized belatedly that she couldn't have told her part of it honestly in front of Roger. She hadn't even told him everything when she'd found him again, seeing how furious he was at the details she had shared.
No, she said slowly. I can tell you now. At least my part of it.
And washing down the last bannock crumbs with a handful of cold water, she began.
Yes, her mother did know men, she thought, seeing Ian's fist clench on his knee, and hearing the low, involuntary growl her father made at hearing about Rob Cameron's cornering her in the study at Lallybroch. She didn't tell him what he'd said, the crude threats, the orders, nor what she'd done, taking off her jeans at his command, then slashing him across the face with the heavy denim before tackling him and knocking him to the floor. She did mention smashing the wooden box of letters over his head, and the two of them made small mm-hmm of satisfaction.
Where did the box come from? She interrupted herself to ask her father. Roger found it in his adopted father's garage. That's a place where you park a car. I mean, she added when she saw a look of confusion touch Jamie's face, never mind. It was a sort of storage shed. But we always wondered where you'd put it at this end.
Och, that.
Jamie's face relaxed a bit.
Roger Mack had told me how his father was a priest and lived for a great many years at his manse in Inverness. We made 3 boxes. It was a good bit of work to copy out all the letters, mind, and I had them sealed and sent to 3 different banks in Edinburgh with instructions that in such and such a year each box was to be sent on to the Reverend Wakefield at the manse in Inverness. We hoped at least one would turn up.
I put Jamie's whole name on each one, thinking that would mean something to you, but no one else.
Go on, though. You smashed yon Cameron Wheeler box and then...
It didn't knock him out all the way, but I got past him and into the hall. So I ran down to the hall tree. It's not the same as the one your parents have, she said to Ian, and then remembered what one of the last letters had said. Oh, God, your father, Ian. I'm so sorry.
Oh, aye, he said, looking down.
She'd grasped his forearm, and he put his own big hand over hers and squeezed it lightly.
Dinna fashion, Ian. I feel him wi' me now and then.
And Uncle Jamie brought my mam back from Scotland.
Oh, Jesus.
He stopped, looking at her round-eyed.
She doesna ken you're here. She'll find out soon enough, Jamie said testily. Will you tell me what the devil happened to this gobshite Cameron?
Not enough, she said grimly, and finished the story, including Cameron's conspirators and the shootout of the OK Corral. So I took Jem and Mandy and went to California. It's on the other side of America, to think what to do. And finally I decided that there wasn't any choice. We had to try to find Roger. He'd left a letter that told me he was in Scotland, and when. So we did. And? She gestured widely to the wilderness around them. Here we are. Jamie drew in air through his nose, but said nothing. Nor did Ian, though he nodded briefly as though to himself. Brianna felt strangely comforted by the proximity of her kin, eased by having told them the story, confided her fears. She felt protected in a way she hadn't for a good long time.
There it goes, Ian said suddenly, and she followed the direction of his gaze, seeing the sudden wild swaying as the rose briars gave way to the bear's bulk, waddling slowly away.
Ian stood up and offered Brianna a hand. She stretched to her full height and swayed, easing her limbs. She felt so easy in mind that she barely heard what her father said, rising behind her. What's that? She said, turning to him.
I said, there's the one thing more, isn't there?
More, she said, with a half-smile. Isn't this enough to be going on with? Jamie made a Scottish noise in his throat, half-apology, half-warning.
Yon Robert Cameron, he said. He likely read our letters, you said.
A trickle of ice water began a slow crawl down the groove of Brianna's spine. Yes. The sense of peaceful security had suddenly vanished.
Then he kens about the Jacobite gold we keep hidden wi' the whisky, and he also kens where we are. If he knows, so do his friends. And he maybe canna travel through the stones, but there are maybe those who can.
Jamie gave her a very direct blue look.
Sooner or later, someone will come looking.
Chapter 3. Rustic, rural, and very romantic. The sun was barely up, but Jamie was long gone. I'd awakened briefly when he'd kissed my forehead, whispered that he was going hunting with Brianna, then kissed my lips and vanished into the chilly dark. I woke again 2 hours later in the warm nest of old quilts. These donated by the Crombies and the Lindsays that served us for a bed, and sat up, cross-legged in my shift, combing leaves and grass heads out of my hair with my fingers, and enjoying the rare feeling of waking slowly rather than with the oft-experienced sensation of having been shot from a cannon. I supposed, with a pleasant little thrill, that once the house was habitable, and the Mackenzies, along with Fergus and Massali's son Germain, and Fanny, an orphan left with us after the horrible death of her sister, were all ensconced within, mornings would once more resemble the exodus of bats from Carlsbad Cavern that I'd seen once in a Disney nature special. For now, though,
the world was bright and filled with peace. A vividly red ladybug dropped out of my hair and down the front of my shift, which put an abrupt end to my ruminations. I leapt up and shook the beetle out into the long grass by the big log, went into the bushes for a private moment, and came out with a bunch of fresh mountain mint. There was just enough water left in the bucket for me to have a cup of tea, so I left the mint on the flat surface Jamie had adzed at one end of a huge fallen poplar log to serve as work table and food preparation space, and went to build up the fire and set the kettle inside the ring of blackened stones. At the far edge of the clearing below, a thin spiral of smoke rose from the Higginses' chimney like a snake out of a charmer's basket. Someone had poked up their smoured fire as well. Who would be my first visitor this morning? Germain, perhaps. He'd slept at the Higgins cabin last night with Jemmy, but he wasn't an early riser by temperament any more than I was. Fanny was a good distance away with the widow Donaldson and her enormous brood. She'd be along later. It would be Roger, I thought, and felt a lifting of my heart. Roger and the children. The fire was licking at the tin kettle. I lifted the lid and shredded a good handful of mint leaves into the water, first shaking the stems to dislodge any hitchhikers. The rest I bound with a twist of thread and hung among the other herbs suspended from the rafters of my makeshift surgery. This, consisting of four poles with a lattice laid across the top, covered with hemlock branches for shade and shelter. I had two stools, one for me and one for the patient of the moment, and a small, crudely built table to hold whatever implements I needed to have easily to hand. Jamie had put up a canvas lean-to beside the shelter to provide privacy for such cases as required it, and also as storage for food or medicines kept in raccoon-proof casks, jars, or boxes. It was rural, rustic, and very romantic. In a bug-ridden, grimy-ankled, exposed to the elements, occasional creeping sensation on the back of the neck indicating that you were being eyed up by something, considering eating you, sort of way. But still. I cast a longing look at the new foundation. The house would have two handsome fieldstone chimneys. One had been halfway built and stood sturdy as a monolith amid the framing timbers of what would shortly, I hoped, be our kitchen and eating space. Jamie had assured me that he would frame the large room and tack on a temporary canvas roof within the next few weeks so we could resume sleeping and cooking indoors. The rest of the house. That might depend on whatever grandiose notions he and Brianna had conceived during their conversation the night before. I seem to recall wild remarks about concrete and indoor plumbing, which I rather hoped wouldn't take root, at least not until we had a roof over our heads and a floor under our feet. On the other hand, the sound of voices on the path below indicated that my expected company had arrived, and I smiled. On the other hand, we'd have two more pairs of experienced and competent hands to help with the building. Jem's dishevelled red head popped into view, and he broke into a huge grin at sight of me.
"Granny!"
he shouted, and brandished a slightly mangled corn dodger.
"We brought you breakfast."
They had brought me breakfast, lavish by my present standards. Two fresh corn dodgers, griddled sausage patties wrapped in layers between burdock leaves, a boiled egg still hot, and a quarter inch of Amy's last year's huckleberry jam in the bottom of its jar.
"Mrs. Higgins says to send back the empty jar,"
Jemmy informed me, handing it over. Only one eye was on the jar. The other was on the big log which had been hidden by darkness the night before.
"Whoa, what kind of tree is that?"
"Poplar," I said, closing my eyes in ecstasy at the first bite of sausage. The big log was roughly 60 feet long. It had been a good bit longer before Jamie had scavenged wood from the top for building and fires. Your grandfather says it was likely more than 100 feet tall before it fell. Mandy was trying to get up onto the log, Jem gave her a casual boost, then leaned over to look down the length of the trunk, mostly smooth and pale, but scabbed here and there with remnants of bark and odd little forests of toadstools and moss.
"Did it blow down in a storm?"
"Yes," I said. "The top had been struck by lightning, but I don't know whether that was the same storm that knocked it down. It might have died because of the lightning, and then the next big storm blew it over. We found it like this when we came back to the ridge. Mandy, be careful there." She'd scrambled to her feet and was walking along the trunk, arms stretched out like a gymnast, one foot in front of the other. The trunk was a good 5 feet in diameter at that point. There was plenty of room atop it, but it would be a hard bump if she fell off.
"Here, sweetheart."
Roger, who'd been looking at the house site with interest, came over and plucked her off the log.
"Why don't you and Jem go gather wood for Granny? Do you remember what good firewood looks like?"
"Aye, of course."
Jem looked lofty.
"I'll show her how." "I knows how,"
Mandy said, glowering at him.
"You have to look out for sneaks,"
he informed her. She perked up at once, peak forgotten.
"Wanna see a sneak?"
"Jem,"
Roger began, but Jemmy rolled his eyes.
"I know, Dad," he said. "If I find a little one, I'll let her touch it, but not if it's got rattles or cotton mouth."
"Oh, Jesus,"
Roger muttered, watching them go off hand in hand. I swallowed the last of the corn dodgers, licked sugary jam from the corner of my mouth, and gave him a sympathetic look. "Nobody died the last time you lived here," I reminded him. He opened his mouth to reply, but closed it again, and I remembered. Mandy nearly had died last time, which meant that whatever had made them come back now...
"It's all right," he said firmly,
in answer to what must have been a very apprehensive look on my face. He smiled a little and took me by the elbow, drawing me into the shade of my surgery.
"It's okay,"
he said, and cleared his throat.
"We're okay," he said more loudly. "We're all here safe and sound. Nothing else matters right now."
"All right," I said, only slightly reassured. "I won't ask." He laughed at that, and the dappled light made his worn face young again.
"We'll tell you," he assured me, "but most of it's really Bree's story. You should hear it from her. I wonder what they're hunting, she and Jamie."
"Probably each other," I said, smiling. "Sit down." I touched his arm, turning him toward the high stool.
"Each other?"
He adjusted himself comfortably on the stool, feet tucked back under him. Sometimes it's hard to know what to say, how to talk to each other when you haven't seen a person in a long time, especially when it's a person who's important to you. It takes a bit of time to feel comfortable again, easier if there's a job at hand. "Let me look at your throat, will you?"
"You don't feel comfortable talking to me yet?"
he asked lightly. "Oh, yes," I assured him. "Doctors never have trouble in talking to people. You start by telling them to take off their clothes, and that breaks the ice. By the time you've done poking them and peering into their orifices, the conversation is usually fairly animated, if not necessarily relaxed." He laughed, but his hand had unconsciously grasped the neckband of his shirt, pulling the fabric together.
"To tell you the truth," he said, trying to look serious, "we only came for the free babysitting. We haven't been more than 6 feet away from the kids in the last 4 months."
He laughed, then choked a little, and it ended in a small coughing fit. I laid my hand on his and smiled. He smiled back, though with less certainty than before, and pulling his hand back, he quickly unbuttoned his shirt and spread the cloth away from his neck. He cleared his throat, hard.
"Don't worry," I said. "You sound much better than you did last time I saw you."
Actually, he did, and that rather surprised me. His voice was still broken, rasping, and hoarse, but he spoke with much less effort, and no longer looked as though that effort caused him constant pain. Roger raised his chin, and I reached up carefully, fitting my fingers about his neck just under his jaw. He'd recently shaved. His skin was cool and slightly damp, and I caught a whiff of the shaving soap I made for Jamie, scented with juniper berries. Jamie must have brought it for him early this morning. I was moved by the sense of ceremony in that small gesture, and moved much more by the hope in Roger's eyes. Hope he tried to hide.
"I met a doctor," he said gruffly, "in Scotland. Hector McEwen was his name. He was one of us."
My fingers stilled, and so did my heart. "A traveller, you mean?" He nodded.
"I need to tell you about him, about what he did. But that can wait a bit."
"What he did?" I repeated. "To you, you mean?"
"Aye. Though it was what he did to Buck first."
I was about to ask what had happened to Buck when he looked suddenly into my eyes, intent.
"Have you ever seen blue light?" he asked. "When you touch somebody in a medical way, I mean, to heal them."
Goose flesh rippled up my arms and neck, and I had to take my fingers off his neck because they were trembling. "I haven't done it myself," I said carefully. "But I saw it once." I was seeing it again, as vivid in my mind's eye as it had been in the shadows of my bed at L'Hôpital des Anges when I had miscarried Faith and been dying of puerperal fever. When Master Raymond had laid his hands on me and I had seen the bones in my arm glow blue through my flesh. I dropped that vision like a hot plate and realized that Roger was gripping my hand.
"I didn't mean to scare you," he said.
"I'm not scared," I said, half truthfully. "Just shocked. I hadn't thought about it in years."
"It scared the shit out of me,"
he said frankly, and let go of my hand.
"After he did what he did to Buck's heart, I was afraid to talk to him. But I knew I had to. And when I touched him, to stop him, you know, I was following him up a path. He froze.
And then he turned round and put his hand on my chest." His own hand rose unconsciously and rested on his chest. "And he said the same thing to me that I'd heard him say to Buck. Cognosco te.
It means I know you," he clarified,
seeing the blank look on my face, in Latin.
"He knew what you were just by touching you?"
The oddest feeling was rippling over my shoulders and down my arms. Not exactly fear, but something like awe.
"Yes. I couldn't tell about him,"
he added hastily.
"I didn't feel anything strange just then. But I was watching closely earlier when he put his hand on Buck's chest. Buck had some sort of heart attack when we came through the stones.
He came with you and Bree and..." Now Roger made the same helpless gesture.
"No, this was earlier. Anyway, Buck was in a bad way, and the people who'd taken him in had sent for a doctor, this Hector McEwen.
And he laid his hand on Buck's chest and did wee things, and I saw.
I really did, Claire. I saw it.
A faint blue light come up through his fingers and spread over his hand.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ."
He laughed.
"Aye, exactly. Nobody else could see it, though,"
he added, laughter fading out of his face.
"Only me."
I rubbed the palms of my hands slowly together, imagining it. "Buck," I said, "I assume he survived, since you asked if we'd seen him." Roger's face changed at that, a shadow passing behind his eyes.
"He did.
Then, but we separated after I found Bree and the kids. It's a long story," I finished for him. "Maybe it should wait until Jamie and Bree come back from their hunting. But about this Dr. McEwen, did he tell you anything about the blue light?" The words felt strange to say, and yet I could envision it. My palms tingled slightly at the thought, and I looked down at them involuntarily. No, still pink. Roger was shaking his head.
Not much, no, not in words. But he put his hand on my throat.
His own hand rose, touching the ragged scar left by the hangman's rope.
And something happened, he said softly.
Chapter 4.
The women will hear fit.
Would you come aside to the cabin, cousin? Ian said, looking uncharacteristically shy. In case Rachel might be back, I'd like you to meet her.
I'd love to meet her, Bree said, smiling at him, and meant it.
She lifted an eyebrow at her father, but he nodded.
It'll be good to put this lot down for a bit, he said, wiping a sleeve across his perspiring face. And if you've milked the goats, as your mother asked you to do this morning, Ian, I wouldn't say no to a cup of it either.
He and Ian were carrying the usable remains of the deer, bound into an unwieldy package inside the mostly intact skin, and hanging from a stout pole that they bore across their shoulders. It was a hot day. Someone was home at the cabin in the aspen grove. The door stood open, and there was a small spinning wheel standing on the front stoop amid the darting leaf shadows, and a chair beside it, with a flat basket piled with brown and grey puffs of what Brianna assumed must be combed clean wool. There was no sign of the spinner, but women were singing inside the house in Gaelic, breaking off every few bars in laughter, with one clear voice then singing the word over again, and the second after it, stumbling over an occasional word, then laughing again. Jamie smiled, hearing it.
Jenny's teaching wee Rachel the Gaelic, he said unnecessarily. Set it down here, Ian.
He nodded at the pool of shade under a fallen log.
The women will hear fit if we bring flies into the house.
Someone in the house had heard them, for the singing stopped, and a head poked out of the open door.
Ian!
A tallish, very pretty, dark-haired girl popped out and hopped off the porch, grabbing Ian round the middle in exuberant embrace. This instantly returned.
Thy cousins have come. Does thee know?
I do,
he said, kissing her mouth.
Come, say hello to my cousin Brianna, Mograi. Oh, and Uncle Jamie, too, he added, turning round.
Bree was already smiling, moved by the obvious love between the young Murrays, and glancing at her father, she saw the same smile on his face. Saw it broaden as he looked beyond them to the open door, where a small woman had come out, a baby wearing nothing but a clout in her arms.
Who?
She began. And then her eye fell on Brianna, and her mouth dropped open.
Blessed bride protect us, she said mildly,
but her eyes were warm, blue, and slanted like Jamie's, smiling up at Brianna.
The giants have come. And your husband too, they say, and him even taller than yourself, lass. And you've bairns too, they say, all of them springing up like weeds, I reckon.
Toadstools, Bree said, laughing, and bent down to hug her diminutive aunt. Jenny smelled of goats, fresh wool, porridge, and toasted yeast bread, and a faint scent in her hair and clothes that Bree had long forgotten, but recognised instantly as the soap Jenny had made at Lullibroch, with honey and lavender, and a Highland herb that had no name in English.
It's so good to see you, she said,
and felt tears well in her eyes, for the soap brought back Lullibroch as she'd first seen it, and with that ghost, another, stronger one behind it, the ghost of her own Lullibroch. She blinked back the tears and straightened up, a tremulous smile pasted on her face. This vanished at once, though, she remembered.
Oh, Auntie, I'm so sorry. About Uncle Ian, I mean.
A new wave of loss washed through her. Even though Ian Murray, the elder, had been dead all of her life, save for a few brief years, and she'd met him only once, the loss seemed fresh and shocking now. Jenny looked down, patting the baby's tender back. He had a downy head of brown blonde fuzz like a guinea hen's chick.
Ach, she said softly,
my Ian's wee mistel. I can see him in this wee un's face, clear as day. She turned the baby deftly so he rested on her hip, looking up at Brianna with big round eyes. Eyes the same warm light brown of her cousin Ian and his father. Oh, Brianna said, charmed and comforted at once. She reached out a tentative hand and offered the baby a finger. And your name is Oggy? Jenny and Rachel both laughed, one with honest amusement and the other ruefully.
I'm afraid we haven't managed to find the proper name for him as yet, Rachel said, touching him gently on the shoulder.
Oggy turned toward his mother's voice and kept on turning, leaning slowly out of Jenny's arms, like a sloth drawn ineluctably toward sweet fruit. Rachel gathered him up, gently touching his cheek. He turned his head again slowly and started sucking on her knuckle.
Ian says that Mohawk children find their proper names when they're older and have just cradle names until then.
Jenny's shapely black eyebrows rose at this. You mean to tell me that the bairn's going to be Oggy until when?
Oh, no, Rachel assured her. I'm sure I'll think of something before when.
She smiled at her mother-in-law, who rolled her eyes and turned her attention back to Brianna. I'm glad you didn't have such trouble with your own bairns and Ian. Jamie said in his letters that they're called Jeremiah and Amanda. Is that right?
Brianna coughed, avoiding Rachel's eye. Jeremiah Alexander Ian Fraser Mackenzie, she said, and Amanda Claire Hope Mackenzie.
Jenny nodded approvingly, whether at the quality or the quantity of the names.
Jenny!
Bree's father appeared on the porch, sweaty and dishevelled, blood-stained shirt much in evidence.
Ian canna find the beer.
We drank it,
Jenny called back, not turning a hair. Oh. He disappeared back into the house, presumably in search of something else potable, leaving damp, slightly bloody footprints on the porch.
What's happened to him?
Jenny demanded, shooting a sharp glance from the footprints to Brianna, who shrugged.
A bear.
Oh. She seemed to digest this for a moment, then shook her head. I suppose I'll have to let him have beer then. She disappeared after the menfolk, leaving Brianna and Rachel outside.
I don't think I've ever met a Quaker before, Brianna said after a slightly awkward pause. Is Quaker the right word, by the way? I don't mean to. We say friend, Rachel said, smiling again. Quaker is not offensive, though, but I think thee must have met at least one. Thee might not know if the friend chose not to use plain speech in talking with thee. Most of us don't have stripes, spots, or any other physical mark by which thee might discern us.
Most of you?
Well, naturally, I cannot see my own back, but I'm sure Ian would have told me, was there anything remarkable?
Brianna laughed, feeling slightly giddy from hunger, relief, and the simple, recurrent joy at being with her family again. A charmingly expanded family, too, it seemed.
I'm really glad to meet you, she said to Rachel. I couldn't imagine what sort of girl would marry Ian.
I'm sorry, that sounds wrong.
No, thee is quite right, Rachel assured her. I couldn't have imagined marrying a man like him either. But there he is in my bed each morning, nonetheless. They do say the Lord moves in mysterious ways. Come into the house.